We've got something different this week, a civil, cool-headed conversation about Colin Kaepernick's value as a football player. Plus, we'll be joined by former NFL offensive lineman and current analyst Ross Tucker to talk what it's like to block for untraditional players like Kaepernick and Le'Veon Bell, and why so many recent first-round linemen have been busts. All that and much more on the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling, here as always with Andy Benoit. We're doing something a little bit different this week. We're taking a break from the position rankings. You can catch up with the ones that already aired the last couple weeks. But we are going to talk a little bit of Colin Kaepernick at the top of the show here. Andy had some opinions that he shared. I don't necessarily disagree strongly with Andy, but I don't quite see eye to eye to him on this. And we're going to have a little conversation about it.
And I'm looking forward to that very much so. And where do you want to begin this conversation? Because there's a multitude of elements for it, and each one of them could be their own show, and we don't want to do 10 shows here. So where do you want to go with this, Gary?
Well, let's jump. We should say at the top, I mean, look, we are an X's and O's football podcast, so we're not going to delve deeply into the some of the societal issues that are at play here. You know, we'll just say, and we've addressed this in the past on the show, Andy and I have both said flat out, you know, we admire Kaepernick for what he did last year. And, you know, it certainly showed a lot of courage. And I think there's, you know, I think there's little doubt that had that not happened, had he not done the anthem protest, he would be in the league, or at the very least, he'd be getting workouts right now around the league.
I agree with you. I think the anthem protests have complicated that, because it's a non-football discussion that owners and therefore coaching staffs must have when evaluating the guy. And at the end of it, they say, you know what, this is a complicated issue, and the guy is not good enough to deal with the complication. He doesn't warrant the trouble. That's where it stands. And I'm with you on what he's done, but we're not, you know, we're not sociologists, we're not historians, so we're not going to talk about why we agree or disagree with Kaepernick for his stance. I think it takes courage to do what he did, and he stood by that, and we're going to talk about him on the field now.
So yeah, we'll jump into it here, and we're going to talk X's and O's. And I don't necessarily want to, you know, on Twitter, everyone sort of cooks everything down to the most base and sort of emotionally triggering type of phrasing they can possibly do. So I don't want to use the word bad at any point in this. I mean, it's a very relative term anyway. You know, is Ryan Tannehill bad because he's not Tom Brady? Or is Ryan Fitzpatrick bad because he's a mid-level backup? Or is a guy who can't make a roster, is he bad? I think we both kind of agree, or at least I would say, I shouldn't speak for you at this point, Andy, but I would say Kaepernick's a fringe starter if you're taking a very optimistic look at it.
And I would say, and I guess this is what got people's attention, is that he's a mid-level backup. I think there are 15, at the time I said 15, I've actually thought of a few more, 16 or 17 backup quarterbacks I would take before Colin Kaepernick, and that does not include the rookies. And I don't want to like tread lightly on what he is and worry about being politically incorrect when we're talking about his quarterbacking. What he is to me, Gary, is a grossly flawed quarterback who has an exceptional athletic talent. And I think the discussion, and if I don't think we want to get into debating, well, can you play from the pocket or not? That'd be like debating, is Tom Brady mobile? I mean, Tom Brady will scramble for a first down every five games, but I don't think anybody would ever hold a discussion about his mobility. And if you talk to NFL coaches, that's the same thing with Kaepernick in the pocket. That's not what he is. So if we're to have an intelligent discussion, I think we need to understand or agree that that's not what he is. And really the discussion is, can you take what he is, which is a run-around, scrambling type of QB, a randomized QB, a really talented one, can you take that and make that work for you? To me, that's where the discussion lands.
Yeah, and, you know, I think this is, you know, and Andy wrote the piece last week, which you might have seen on the MMQB, about the 15 backups who he considers better than Kaepernick. I think there was something to be said for sort of stepping back even a little bit more from that, and we're talking basically as broadly as possible here. I always think back to two off seasons ago in Buffalo. You had Matt Cassel and Tyrod Taylor and EJ Manuel, but it was basically Cassel versus Taylor for the starting job with the Bills. The offensive staff seemed to prefer Cassel. That sort of whispers have sort of come through. Rex Ryan was obviously a big Tyrod Taylor supporter. He was the head coach, and that's why Tyrod Taylor ended up the starter. Now, I'm sure the offensive guys are saying, well, we want Cassel because he's better able to operate our offense, whereas Rex said, I want Taylor because he is a handful. I know as a defensive coach, he's a handful with the unpredictability. So it's almost like the unpredictability, while it's problematic for the offensive coaches, it's also problematic for an opposing defensive coach.
Yeah, and that's what's fascinating about it. Because remember 2 years ago I wrote this, and people are going to say, oh, what, you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. We're not here. It gets nuanced at this point. But remember I said I talked to 12 NFL defensive coaches, and I asked them, who would you rather play against? Who do you like facing more, Peyton Manning or Colin Kaepernick? And that got attention because a very solid majority of those coaches said, I'd rather play against Peyton Manning. Yeah. And some of these guys were big-time name coaches who have played against them both, and it would be news in and of themselves if their names got attached to that. And so that's fascinating. That's the same thing you just said about Buffalo. The offensive guys do not want to play with Kaepernick, but the defensive guys also don't want to play against Kaepernick. And the reason for that is coaches hate unpredictability on both sides of the ball. And with Kaepernick, you don't know where things are going. You don't know what the play will turn into because he's not a structured QB. He doesn't play on time. He doesn't play in rhythm. He is a very offbeat quarterback with randomized tendencies. And that is the opposite of what you try to achieve with coaching. That goes against the 5 hours you spend after midnight in your office drawing up extra plays. It goes against everything you teach the rest of your guys. You can't organize your football approach if the guy with the ball is wildly unconventional. So defensive coaches don't like it because they're scared what's going to happen if he's unconventional. We'll be unprepared. Offensive guys hate it for pretty much the same reason. And then the discussion now is, well, what's good? Who's right? Who's wrong? What do you want? But the bottom line below all of that, Gary, if it comes to Kaepernick's employment, is this discussion is what's keeping him out of the NFL. Coaches don't want to deal with it. Coaches, it's just too much to try to figure out, and there's no fallback option and answer. And personally, I'm of the belief, if we're talking backup quarterback, give me someone I can understand and who can be reliable, because then I can at least plug them in and assume that my offense stylistically will keep operating. And that's why I said there are, now I'm up to 17 backups who I would take before Kaepernick. That's the reason why. But you've made great points too that, well, there is maybe some value in plugging in a guy who's totally unconventional if you're bringing him off the bench, because you have a chance to catch lightning in a bottle, so to speak. That was your argument, if I recall.
Yeah, basically. And you know, it kind of comes down to, look, I don't want to throw out Seahawks because they just passed on him, but let's say you're the Denver Broncos and you have a dominant defense and you're going to Cleveland, or Cleveland's coming to your place. That's an extreme example, but obviously give me the guy who's going to be the more conservative and then run the offense on time type of guy. But let's say you're the Pittsburgh Steelers and, you're going to the AFC title game in New England and Ben Roethlisberger is hurt. Do you want Landry Jones or do you want the wild card? Do you want Colin Kaepernick back there and see if, you know, basically you can just, I don't know, shake the whole thing up and let him do his thing, and maybe you, that's your, or I, you know, I would just flat out say that's your best chance for pulling off an upset and putting up more points than you'd be expected to put up.
Well, and within that specific example, I can tell you the Steelers would want Landry Jones, because remember when Roethlisberger went down a few years ago, they put in Michael Vick, who was in a lot of ways the original Kaepernick, a much more dynamic version of Kaepernick even. And Vick was like 3 of 6 for 20 yards passing in the first half of his first start or something like that. The offense just didn't function. But that's not a commentary on the quarterback. That's on the situation. Like in Pittsburgh, they have Le'Veon Bell. They have all those dynamic receivers. They have a very, very good offensive line. Let's say you're another. Let's say you are the Cleveland Browns, and maybe we know the answer to this one, because the other guy, by the way, Gary, who's out here, who did not do an anthem protest and is not politically polarizing, is Robert Griffin, and he's unemployed too, which is just further proof this is a football issue and very little more. But let's say you're the Browns and you don't have a lot of weapons. Do you want to plug in the guy that just randomizes it and maybe hope he can spark something? I don't think even they want to do that, because they had Robert Griffin last year, and I know he got hurt. That was a factor. But at the end of the day, they didn't choose to stick with Robert Griffin. He's not on the team now. He didn't keep the starting job steadily throughout the season. So it's but that's the problem. Kaepernick is so dependent. His style is so much a function of the guys around him, because he's unconventional. You need a very specific type of offense around him, and you need to hope that that offense has been able to at least practice some of the things they'll have to do with Kaepernick. And there aren't teams like that in the NFL. They don't exist. Not very many of them.
Yeah, you know, I would, I mean, look, I would argue that Kaepernick is better than RG3, not miles better, but better at this point. And I would argue that he's miles better than what Michael Vick was a couple years ago in Pittsburgh, where I'm just not sure what was going on there at that point. But to me, this kind of comes down to, you know, you have these coaches, and we've talked about in the past how confident and oftentimes overconfident coaches can be, especially when it comes to stuff that maybe is not their area of expertise. An offensive coach, his area of expertise in life is, you know, building an offense, building a game plan, stuff like that. To expect someone like that to basically say, yeah, I'll take the guy who plays the random style. I don't care if he actually, you know, operates what I have designed. I think it's unrealistic. And I think that's why it took a coach like, you know, obviously Rex Ryan is gone, but I thought that was especially appealing with the Seahawks as a fit. You have Pete Carroll, a guy with a defensive background. He might be more willing to take that type of approach with his backup quarterback.
Well, I think the other part of it, because I thought Kaepernick as a backup in Seattle would have been a great fit. And in fact, Kaepernick as a Seahawk, to me, there probably wouldn't be 17 quarterbacks I'd rather have if he's a Seahawk. Chances are he's in some other system, though, and the flaws show up. In Seattle, the flaws do not necessarily show up as much, because those other players, keep in mind, the quarterback plays with 10 other guys, and their job is to protect and help the quarterback. And those receivers across the league, where they line up, if it's 1 foot to the left or 2 feet to the right in their splits, that's a big difference. Their timing, their routes, everything in the NFL is precision driven. And so when you take a quarterback like Kaepernick, you compromise all the work that those receivers have done on their precision. So you waste their practice reps, essentially, because the stuff they perfected no longer gets enacted or rewarded the same way, because the ball's not coming out on time. The ball's not where it's supposed to be. Having said that, there are teams that have gotten very good at playing off schedule like that. In Seattle, with Russell Wilson's the best example. Russell Wilson and Kaepernick are similar stylistically. And the reason, by the way, that Wilson's become a superstar, and I would probably put him in the lower tier of superstars, and Kaepernick's out of the league, is Wilson has learned to play from the pocket a little bit. He goes against all the stereotypes of guys that he comes in and runs around. That's what he is as a quarterback. You can learn to be in the pocket a little bit. Kaepernick has not learned it. He's gotten worse each year because of that. Wilson, to his immense credit, has gotten much better each year. It's been a lot of fun to watch. And so Seattle's a more consistent offense. But because of what he's done and how he used to play, those guys that play with Wilson, they can still go into the sandlot mode at times. So they would have been conducive for Kaepernick to be the backup there. Gary, I'm sure the reason why. The question, if Seth Wickersham and that piece on ESPN, the magazine, if that had not come out with the questions about Wilson's place in the locker room, I think Kaepernick is a Seahawk. I think they didn't want him, not because of his political drama or whatever follows him, but because of their own. I don't think they wanted anything that looked the least bit threatening to Wilson from the outside. People in that building would know Kaepernick's not going to supplant Wilson. He's not close to what Wilson is. But people outside the building don't know that, and so the chatter continues, the articles, the investigative reporting, all that stuff would have picked up around Russell Wilson, and that's why Seattle didn't want to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Pete Carroll is, look, Pete Carroll's a nice guy. I don't take that quote at face value that, you know, Kaepernick was too good to be a backup type of thing.
No, that's, no team has ever refused to sign a guy because, oh, he's too good. We can't have him. He's too good.
Yeah, and one more, just to pull it back to Buffalo again before we do a couple more loose ends on this, but, you know, a lot of folks said when the Bills, you know, T.J. Yates might be the main backup for Tyrod Taylor. They also drafted Nathan Peterman in the fifth round. So, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, those are two guys who aren't like Tyrod Taylor. Tyrod Taylor is going to get pulled to Rick Dennison's system more than Rick Dennison's system is going to be tailored for Tyrod Taylor. Yeah, that's a terrible play on
saying,
words
what,
that I actually
no,
said.
What you're saying is if Tyrod Taylor doesn't play well under Rick Dennison this year, he's probably gone from Buffalo.
Yeah, they're not going to design it. You know, there's this assumption that they're going to do, you know, the Bills will do the same thing they did last year. So how can you bring in T.J. Yates? And the answer is basically they're going to ask Taylor to do what a Rick Dennison quarterback would do. And Taylor has played you know, he's been a backup for Dennison. So has T.J. Yates. That's why they are probably both there at this point. But
And they're going to do – what Rick Dennison does is not exactly what Greg Roman or Anthony Lynn did last year either.
Yeah.
It's – they're different styles. And Taylor's got flaws as well. I mean, he needs to be better from the pocket. He's certainly further along than Kaepernick is. And he might never be a true pocket passer. That doesn't mean he can't play. I would still say Russell Wilson is not a true pocket passer, but you have to have some semblance of ability to do that. Taylor has some, but there are a lot of issues there with Tyrod Taylor too, and they're similar to what you see with Kaepernick, less extreme. But I think if Taylor doesn't play well for Rick Dennison, that's a new coaching staff. It's a new front office. Taylor will be gone. There's no sign right now that he's a franchise quarterback.
We'll see. And look, he's familiar with Dennison's offense, so maybe that leads to a little more comfort there. But he looks at the moment like a placeholder out there. But yeah, I was just more making the point. A lot of people, when Yates got signed, said, oh, look at that. There's a backup who doesn't fit the starter style, doesn't play the same style as a starter. And I just sort of make the point. The Bills are going to not make Tyrod Taylor play exactly as T.J. Yates would play, but they're going to have their system, and they're going to make Taylor mold to that system as opposed to, sort of let him do some of the things that sort of emphasized his mobility that they did under Anthony Lynn and Greg Roman.
Well, and one thing, Taylor can make throws on the move. He's pretty good at that, and he's probably the best pure deep ball thrower in the league. He's sensational when he's launching the ball. So his mobility translates better to quarterback mobility. Kaepernick's not an on-the-move passer. He has an elongated throwing motion. There's not a lot of precision there. His great passes are as great as anyone's. I remember the Miami game towards the end of Miami. He looked like a Hall of Fame quarterback on that drive. So he does some things great, but he is not an on-the-move, versatile passer. So it's hard to even turn his mobility into something productive for the offense. It's hard to design ways to emphasize his mobility the same way you can with Tyrod Taylor or Russell Wilson or obviously Aaron Rodgers. Pick any of these run-around, on-the-move type of quarterbacks.
Yeah. And, you know, one other thing, just tying Taylor into Kaepernick. One thing I do like about it, and why I'd say Kaepernick is a fringe starter, one thing I do like about Kaepernick, same reason I like Taylor a little bit, is few turnovers, limits of turnovers. So as problematic as it is to miss throws that are available and not see them and not make them, the most problematic thing is a guy who's going to throw two or three picks every week.
Right, absolutely, and that's probably my last argument with the Kaepernicks of the world is the throws that should be made that are not made, that are not attempted. That's a big problem to coaches, and there's no stat for it, and there's no way for fans to see it on TV. So it's this whole secret world of bad quarterbacking in the NFL, so to speak. Yeah. But what you just said is 100% right. Worse than that are throws that shouldn't have been made that were made and got intercepted, and you're right. Kaepernick, to his credit, he does not turn the ball over a whole lot.
Yeah, Andy, I have one more loose end that I want to tie up on this. If you read Andy's piece, and full disclosure, I often edit Andy at the MMQB, not all the time, but I try to as often as possible. And I told you off the air, I never would have let you bring up the T word if I had not been on vacation and been at Sesame Place with my kids while this whole thing was playing out last week. But the Tebow comparison, and I get where you're coming from with the Tebow comparison, and I think you're being disingenuous for anyone who wants to score Twitter points by sort of saying, oh, hey, Tebow isn't Kaepernick's political opposite. If it was that way, Tebow would be out killing African Americans or something like that. Tebow, I get your point. Tebow appeals generally to right wing populace, and Kaepernick appeals generally to left wing populace. But no one would have boycotted. No one was threatening to boycott a team if they signed Tebow. The problem with Tebow was people loved him too much. People believed in him too much, and everywhere he went, everyone thought he should be the starter. And this is everyone obviously outside the building and people who don't follow football terribly closely all thought Tim Tebow should have been a starter wherever he went, and that was sort of the bigger issue there. That was the circus that followed him, a different type of circus, but no one was necessarily walking away. Teams weren't going to get hurt on the business side. As a matter of fact, they probably would have been helped on the business side if they signed Tim Tebow. But that's the quandary at any team interested in Kaepernick finds himself in, because people are, whether it's they should be or not, they are very upset with the anthem protests last year.
And the Tebow comparison, there's two parts of it. It's from the ownership perspective, which is what you're talking about with people never would have boycotted a team that signed Tebow. They might with Kaepernick, and that's all valid. And that's not, again, I'm not a sociologist or historian. I that didn't even enter my mind. There's the coaching perspective, which is what I was thinking of, which is what you said about if Tebow comes aboard, there's going to be legions of big-time fans that believe he should be the starter. He's a winner. How could you not give him a chance? Why don't people like this guy? And that's a big distraction when it's a quarterback especially, and that's what coaches didn't want to deal with. And Tebow was never considered for a starting quarterback job legitimately, even after he went to the playoffs with Denver in 2011 that he did that? Mm-hmm. So, and he just disappeared, and people were amazed. How can that happen? What's the conspiracy against Tebow? That's the comparison to me with Kaepernick. It's not a great one. It's not apples to apples, and I get your point on it. But we're talking at the end of the day, and Tebow was a much, much worse player than Kaepernick is. At the end of the day, though, we're talking about grossly flawed quarterbacks with big followings, big high-profile names that bring attention, and that attention brings disruption, and the disruption, given the flaws, it's just not worth the trouble. And that's what I was at least trying to get at with Tebow. I think everything you've said here is very valid.
I just want to wrap this up on a light note, Andy. I was at Sports Illustrated Kids when Tebow was in camp with the Patriots, and jokingly, we had a reader survey who should be the Patriots' starting quarterback, Tom Brady or Tim Tebow. And, we got tens of thousands of responses, and Tim Tebow won 54% to 46%. So that's...
The imagination of children is just
exactly
a wonderful thing.
The world that could have been in Foxborough. But that's a wrap. I just wanted to give a little more clarity on this, because I think, look, everything gets sort of wrapped up in the Twitter tsunami here, and sort of valid points get lost in that. And I just wanted us to sort of sort of clear the air here a little bit, because you do have valid points, and I still disagree. I'm not going to sit here and say Colin Kaepernick should absolutely be someone's starter, but, you know, I think he belongs in the league, and I think he's a guy who's a potential bridge guy for a team, and that's about it. And, you know, if not for the anthem protests, I think we can both agree he'd be in the league right now. So it's not necessarily an active blackballing, but you know, it's an effective blackball, as our colleague Jonathan Jones would say.
Yeah, that's fair. It's a complicating situation, complicated now, and he isn't worth the complications and the troubles that come with complicated. I'm glad, Gary, I appreciate that we have the conversation and we're talking football here on this podcast, because our listeners, we hear from you guys a lot, and it's overwhelmingly not only positive and but it's also smart. And if it's negative and smart, that's great too. We have a great listenership, and I'm glad it was on this platform that we do it, and not back and forth in 140 characters, which is how people want it to be done. So this I hope was productive. And at the end of it all, we're still talking football. We're talking who's good, who's bad, who's in between. That's football.
Yeah. Yep. And more smart football talk coming up here. We have a guest this week. Coming up next, our conversation with Ross Tucker.
This is the MMQB 10 Things Podcast.
All right, now joining us, we're doing a little something different here. We have a guest. This is Ross Tucker. You might know him from Westwood One or Sirius Radio if you listen to games, but we know him mostly from the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, one of the best shows out there. And, you know, Ross, it looks like it took you 651 shows to perfect it, but you finally did, and you got Andy Benoit on your podcast.
You know what's funny about that is I think I actually was doing shows before that. I don't know when that counter actually started, because it's 5 days a week during the NFL season and 3 days a week in the off season. I've been doing it for, man, at least 5-6 years now. So I don't know when, you know, that counter on the website started, but I think it's actually even more than that. But yes, we did finally get Andy on, and he did a terrific job on Monday's podcast. I love the guys that put the time in to watch the tape, watch every play, and then let us know what they saw or what their evaluation is. And obviously people have different opinions. No matter how much time you put in, how much effort you put in, people aren't going to see the, you know, things the same way, which is part of what makes it great.
Well, and I appreciate that, Ross. And one thing I was mentioning to our listeners last episode, because you were, are you offended if I say you were an NFL journeyman?
Not at all. I am like your textbook journeyman. I mean, I played for 5 teams in 7 years, including the Redskins twice. And we can talk about how you become a journeyman and the pros and cons of that and whatever. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why things happen, but I never get offended by that at all, because if you're a journeyman, at least you had a journey.
Right.
at least you were journeying. It'd be much better than, let's bring on Ross Tucker. He's a cup of coffee offensive lineman. You know, like,
right.
Journeyman offensive lineman is a lot better than cup of coffee offensive lineman.
Well, and for what you do now, I think it really benefits you. You have such a multitude of experiences in so many different settings and systems, and you've seen football from a different angle, a lot of different ways. I believe you played multiple positions. So your journeyman career, which was short-lived, like everybody's NFL career, has probably aided you to your analyst career, which is going to be a long-lived career.
Well, and you're exactly right, and it's really on a couple different levels. So number one, I do games for Westwood One, and pretty much every game I go to, there's at least a couple of assistant coaches. Not as many players anymore, since I retired in 08. There's still a few, but there's at least a couple of assistant coaches that I either, you know, played for, or, you know, they were former teammates of mine. So it really helps before the game on the field to talk with those guys and get some additional insights. And then in terms of scheme and teams and what they're trying to do, I mean, just my head coaches. I had Marty Schottenheimer, then I went to Steve Spurrier, which was night and day. Then I went to Dallas, and I had Dave Campo, and then Bill Parcells, which was again night and day. Then in Buffalo, I had Greg Williams and Mike Mularkey. Then I went to New England with Belichick, traded to Cleveland with Romeo Crennel, and then finished back up in Washington with Joe Gibbs. So I don't think there's many people that can say that they were coached by Joe Gibbs, Bill Parcells, Bill Belichick, Marty Schottenheimer, and, you know, for different reasons, Steve Spurrier. I also had 9 different offensive line coaches. And I guess my biggest takeaway would be it's amazing how many different ways there are to go about it, whether it's the strength and conditioning program or offensive line technique or scheme or head coach style. I mean, there were some similarities between, you know, all the places and all the different coaches I just mentioned, but there were definitely, guys, more differences than there were similarities. And it's just, it's fascinating. You'd think that after all these years, all this time, and how much money is on the line, that there would be more of a standard, I guess, or there'd be a, hey, these are the best practices. It's really not that way yet, at least in the industry, at least while I was playing. Maybe it's more like that now, but while I was playing, it was all over the place.
Yeah.
Well, that's wild. You know, one guy, obviously, it's that time of year when everyone's talking about Colin Kaepernick, and it seems like we'll be doing that until training camp opens, perhaps. But, you know, Andy and I had talked about, we had our top 10 offensive linemen in the league countdown show last week, and one of the things we touched on a little bit was a guy like Colin Kaepernick. He's a little bit, he plays out of structure a lot. He's a little bit, you know, he's a guy who freelances a little bit more than you might see. He's not exactly a, you know, back foot hits the ground and the ball is out. As an offensive lineman, is that problematic for you, guys who sort of don't play on time or on schedule?
You don't like it. And Andy and I talked about this a little bit as well on the Ross Tucker Football Podcast on Monday, because, you know, even if the guy is elusive and you get beat and he makes the guy that beat you miss and makes a terrific play, like, you don't get credit for that. You know what I mean? He gets credit for that. The offensive line coach says, Tucker, what are you doing? That's terrible. And what the real issue is, the longer the quarterback holds onto the ball, this is pretty obvious, the greater their chance is that you're going to be credited with giving up a pressure or a hit on the quarterback or a sack. And then even a guy like Kaepernick, who so often will, like, flush to the outside, that leads to a lot more holding penalties. You know what I mean? Because your whole goal as an offensive lineman is to get your hands inside, whether it's run or pass, to get your hands inside of the defensive lineman's hands and to really try to grab cloth, grab jersey, or certainly if you can grab the breastplate of the shoulder pads and really control the man in that way. Well, you could have your hands inside the framework of the defender's body, which they're never going to call hold typically if that's the case, as the right tackle. But when Kaepernick, you know, flees the pocket, or any quarterback, I don't want to feel like, you know, we're picking on Kaepernick, but any quarterback, they flee to the pocket to that outside to the right, you've got perfect hand placement. You don't really know he's doing that. And so by the time the defensive lineman tries to disengage and get away from you and you realize, oh, that must mean Kaepernick's rolled out here, and you let go, they might have already thrown the flag, because at that point then you are clearly restricting movement. If the quarterback stayed behind you in the pocket, you wouldn't be restricting movement. But if he starts to get outside, then they're going to call you for a hold, and then, you know, they say your number over the loudspeaker and your mom and your wife, like was the case with me, they're all upset because that's the only time they know that you messed up is when they call your name or your number over the loudspeaker or on TV. So my mom used to think I always played great as long as I didn't get any penalties. I'm like, Mom, I gave up 2.5 sacks. What are you talking about? She's like, but they didn't say your name. They didn't say your name. I said, Mom, I'd much rather have one offsides penalty and play play better other than that. So you don't really get any credit for it. I will say this, though. Let's go back to Kaepernick, like circa 2012, 2013. If a team is willing to commit to having a decent amount of quarterback runs and to have, you know, a zone read be a big staple of what they're doing, even though defenses are better at defending it now than they were back then, it still can create some really good angles for the offensive linemen in the run game. So that's a positive, I would say, that we probably don't talk about enough, is that because of the threat of the quarterback run and the need for the defender, you know, the defense to have someone account for him, you can get some better angles in the run game than you normally would. So that would be the positive.
Yeah, something else about the run game that we were wondering, Ross, we had this discussion with David DeCastro. We had it about David DeCastro the other day, and he made our top 10 linemen because I like what he does on counter plays, his pull blocking ability, and that's a big staple for Pittsburgh. And when he's counter blocking, he's blocking for Le'Veon Bell on those pull blocks. Le'Veon Bell's another very unconventional player for different reasons than any quarterback, of course, but he's very patient. His tempo, it's all different. As a lineman blocking for a guy like that, do you have to make any adjustments? Can you even make any adjustments when you have an unconventional runner like Le'Veon Bell behind you?
Well, first of all, I never played with a guy or saw a guy like Le'Veon Bell. I will say that the two running backs, in terms of his running style, the two running backs that I played with that probably most closely resemble Le'Veon that I remember were Willis McGahee and Emmitt Smith. They had a tremendous ability to be patient, allow you to get into your double team, and to try to start to work off that double team. And even if there wasn't tremendous movement, those guys were so good at still falling forward, finding a little crack, and getting 3 or 4 yards. I mean, when I played in Dallas with Emmitt, it was his last year in Dallas, 2002. It was the year he broke the all-time rushing record. I got there, guys, and I'm 23 years old. I've been watching this guy on TV forever. He was small, and he was slow. But somehow he got yards. It was, and we stunk up front. We were not good at all. And somehow he would find a way to be able to slither through and get yards. And people talk about vision, and that was part of it. But I think he was very patient. Now, not like Le'Veon Bell patient. Le'Veon Bell is like Emmitt or McGahee on steroids patient. It's crazy how much time he takes back there. But I'm sure Munchak preaches to those guys, and I know this is what I would be doing as well if I were them, to never stop your feet, drive, sustain, and somewhat similar to Kaepernick, keep your hands inside because you're going to be blocking longer, so there will be a greater chance of a holding penalty. But so often, guys, you know, almost every run scheme, right, there's at least one or two double teams at the point of attack, or it's somewhere along the line. That they're trying to be designed that way, that at least initially there is some type of double team or two-on-one. Well, especially if it's any type of, you know, inside zone, gap scheme, anything where you're really trying to get vertical displacement, a lot of times those defenders, you know, they're pretty good at butting your initial surge, right? I mean, it's hard to really roll guys off the ball. But if they have to try to stay there, and let's say they're 300 pounds, and they have to try to hold and brace against 630 pounds for a second and a half, 2 seconds, that becomes much tougher. So, you know, they might be able to jump, get a great jump off the snap and get into one of the two guys and be able to hold up initially. So if you're a hard-hitting runner, guys I played with like Travis Henry or Steven Davis, you know, they were just coming downhill hard, real hard. You know, that defender might be able to hold up at the point of attack because those guys hit the hole so hard. But if it's a guy like Le'Veon Bell, eventually you're going to start to get some movement. I mean, it's physics. It's 630 pounds against 300. He might hold up for a half a second, maybe even a second. But eventually you're going to start to walk that guy back a little bit and get some push, some vertical displacement off the ball. And then the linebackers have to bubble over the top. You know, that's why Le'Veon Bell, he's really getting a couple yards before he even gets to the defense because he's so patient. You know, if I was a defensive coach, I would try to be penetrating. I would try to hit the B gap, hit the A gap, get upfield, and force him to make his decision earlier rather than letting, you know, just trying to play technique, just trying to play into the offensive lineman, because it's, you're going to have a tough time holding up for as long as Le'Veon Bell waits.
You know, it took that Steelers line a couple of years to get together. You know, we were probably talking 6-7 years ago. You know, that Pittsburgh offensive line was maybe the weakness of that team, and now it's certainly a strength. We've seen a lot of high draft picks come into the league and struggle. Do you have a reason behind it? Can you sort of pinpoint why some of these guys on the offensive line are coming in and having so much trouble early on?
I think it's a combination of a bunch of different factors. And I know people have talked about this a bunch. Number one, certainly, the lack of practice time doesn't really help, right? I mean, It's like anything else. Those guys need reps. Those guys need to hone their craft. The best way I can describe it is I didn't even know what I didn't know when I was in college. You know, like, you think you're working your technique. You think that, okay, I'm staying low, my footwork, I'm getting my hands inside. Technique is everything in the NFL, and you get so much better at it when you're doing it every day and you're going against professionals. So I think there was always some kind of learning curve for rookie offensive linemen, and I think, you know, what they've done with lessening the practice time has just made that more pronounced. So that's a big factor. Certainly, even at the college level, you know, we talk all the time about quarterbacks are always in the gun. Well, yeah, Especially these offensive tackles, they're always in a two-point stance. You know, they're running these spread air raid offenses where they've got bigger splits. They're always in a two-point stance. And a lot of times, teams in college, they're really trying to beat you with tempo. These guys don't even block that long. You know what I mean? They're really only blocking for like a second half, 2 seconds, and the ball is out. And more power to the college coaches, right? I mean, that's how they're winning at that level, and I don't blame them one bit. I just think these guys come to the NFL, and they haven't really had to sustain blocks as long. They don't really run block nearly the same way as they do in the NFL. They've never been in a three-point stance. They're going up against, you know, more skilled players. They're not having as much practice time. And I also think, you know, we had a really good run there for a while, you know, of guys like Ogden and Pace and Walter Jones that are Hall of Fame caliber players. And so there became this perception that as long as you take an offensive lineman top five, it's a safe play, he'll be great, you know, and that's not really the case. I just think guys like Eric Fisher and Luke Jokel, they were overdrafted. Now, part of that's because they were in the same draft, and that draft was not very good. But I just think, in general, there was this perception and feeling after some of the great guys, you know, last decade, and even in the late 90s, that you could take an offensive tackle high, and that would be a safe play, and it just hasn't necessarily been the case. And I don't know that, you know, look at this year. They didn't really have very many good offensive linemen coming out either. And I can't really figure it out because, you know, these guys are now doing one-on-ones and pass blocking in high school at these elite camps and stuff that, I mean, we never did that. But then the flip side is, look at a guy like Zach Martin. I mean, he goes from left tackle, bumps inside to guard, and switch sides. So not only is tackle and guard a lot different, but your weight transfer, your stance, your hand placement, everything's different from the left side to the right side. So for that guy to go from left tackle to right guard and as a rookie, pretty much already be the best guard in the NFL, that's one of the craziest things I've ever seen. That guy is amazing that he made that transition that well and that quickly.
Yeah, and that's something we talked about last week. We did, on our top 10 linemen, we noticed at the end of the show that with the exception of one or two guys at the top, and Zach Martin has not changed positions once he's come into the NFL, that guys, the top linemen, aren't changing positions a lot because there's such a detail to the craft. And I have heard thousands, I mean not thousands, but every coach I've ever talked to about offensive line play has said what you just said, Ross, and that it's difficult, maybe impossible for some guys to just switch sides left to right and assume that he's going to be the same player. I want to ask you one more thing kind of along these lines, let's say out of 100 times where you've won on a block, where you defeated the opponent, how many times was it simply you overpowering the other man, like people assume all football is? And how many times was it you winning with technique and angles?
Well, at the NFL level, I would say overpowering would maybe be one or two, maybe five. I mean, you know, now it's a little bit different if it's a double team. You know, there are some opportunities then to really, you know, to really overpower a guy. But one-on-one, I mean, nobody's really getting a whole lot of movement out there just based on their, you know, there's not a lot of Larry Allens out there just walking guys off the ball just based on their physical ability. It just doesn't really work that way. So it's almost all angles, technique, head placement, all those things that you work on. Some of that is also, you know, seeing the way the defense is lined up and anticipating what stunt might be coming or what the line movement might be based on where the linebacker is and where the D lineman is and how far off the ball he is and how tight his split is and those type of things. So I would say brains, technique, angles, probably 98%, brawn, maybe 2% at that level. Now, that's not to say, I mean, you better be pretty strong. You're going to get killed. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what separates guys at that level, a lot of times it is the technique stuff. Now, there's guys with great feet, for sure, but a lot of times it is the technique stuff.
Unreal. Yeah, you see some of these guys coming in at 295, some of these agile left tackle types. Guess they got to get in the weight room.
Yeah, you know, we'll see guys like Garrett Bowles. I'm looking forward to seeing how he does. I have often found that weight was not, like, I wish I would have lost weight a little bit more earlier in my career so I could have maintained quickness after my back surgery, because, you know, as you get older, you get a lot of your power from your technique, you know, and so you don't need to weigh as much to be able to, you know, to hold up against a bull rush or whatever, because you're really using your technique as much as anything else.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a wrap there. Ross, we appreciate the time. Once again, if you don't know, Ross Tucker Football Podcast, it really is. If you like this podcast and you like the MMQB stuff, I mean, Andrew Brandt's a regular guest on the show, so you will enjoy the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. You got to go and get it. Some of our other, you have Evan Silva, you have Greg Cassell, you have some of our favorites as regular guests over there.
I try. I got a fantasy podcast and a gambling one. I got a bunch of different offshoots of the NFL as well. It's fun to talk about all the different things related to the NFL that are really popular with fans.
Yeah, I mean, definitely go and find it if you haven't already. It's available on all the regular avenues, or you can just go to rosstucker.com. And if you can't spell Ross Tucker, I don't know, you're too lost to be able to figure this out anyway. But Ross, really appreciate the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Take care.
Gary, I was not surprised at all by his percentages on the overpower thing. I'd asked Joe Thomas that exact same question once, and he had the exact same answer as Ross Tucker. 100 snaps that you appear to overpower a guy. How many times was it just physical strength? And Thomas said maybe one or two. It is a very much a technique-driven game.
I was going to say it's a science, not an art, is what it kind of comes down to. But that's a, you know, offensive line kind of in crisis right now, I feel like. Everyone's sort of searching for the good ones, and everyone's having trouble finding them.
Which makes those guys more valuable, I would assume.
Well, that's going to be a wrap for this week's show. Thank you so much to Ross Tucker for joining us. That was a great conversation. And again, you can catch his podcast, Ross Tucker Football Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you, as always, to producer Lou Pellegrino and editor Chris Basil. Digital media, those guys are the best in the business. Always make us sound good. Most of all, thank you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. If you were a little worried that the position rankings didn't go down this week, we'll be back with it next week. I think maybe cornerbacks, Andy, we'll have to talk about it, but I think I'm going to proclaim now cornerbacks, and therefore it will be cornerbacks. We'll have some mailbags coming up later in the offseason. Keep those questions coming. Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI. We're both on Facebook, or you can write in to talkback@themmqb.com. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archive episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and of course this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including themmqb.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.